Make it, I can hear me. It's not the silence disturbs you, it's you disturb the silence. Okay, sorry. So I make mistakes too. Can you enter jhana as well to walk in meditation? Basically, no, but you can get pretty close. I think I mentioned that to you the other day. Just when I was doing walking meditation, even as a young monk, you got so quiet that a monk was sent to come and get me because I was getting into my meditation so well, and that I forgot the appointment. And then he was shouting, right next to me, shouting in my ear hole, "Bama Wangso! Bama Wangso!" Much louder than that. And it was like he was like miles away. It's like the sense of sound had almost been cut off. But I was still aware of the feelings in my body. That's my focus. And I could see a little bit, just, you know, my eyes on the floor. But really, what we do, there's one monk, we have a photo of him up in our monk's dining hall. And he was a very simple farmer. He just happened to be doing some sort of business over in the Thai town of Sokonakorn at a time when they were doing Ajahn Mun's funeral service. And there's lots of monks in there, so he wondered what was going on. He just went inside and listened to a very simple sermon. And all the sermon said is, if you really want to develop your meditation, walk a lot and sit a lot. That was it. But that he remembered that, and it inspired him. So later on he did ordain as a bhikkhu in a simple forest monastery, and that was his practice. He had a walking meditation path, you know, with sand on it, made it nice and easy. It had a beginning and an end, so when he got to the end, he turned around and walked back again. That's one of the nice things about walking meditation. You never get anywhere. As all these people try and get somewhere, what did you attain? You just end up where you started. But that's only just one aspect of it. The other one is you really focus in this moment. Not where you're going, not where you came from, but just where you are. And whenever he got tired, he wouldn't go back into his hut. He would just sit down right where he got tired, in the middle of the meditation path, or the beginning, or wherever he got tired. And then he would just meditate, close his eyes, cross his legs. And then when he had enough of the sitting meditation, he'd get up and carry on walking. That's all he ever did, walking and sitting, just where he was, as much as he could. And he became one of those monks. You know, if he wasn't enlightened, he was really, really close, maybe a non-returner. And he had his psychic powers as well. People are always interested when I mention psychic powers. We know that because when we went to visit him with the other monk who was with me early on, Ajahn Yanadamo, and we were just chatting and talking about just, where do you come from? We come from Australia. Where's that? That's to the south. You mean further south than Bangkok? Oh yeah, a lot further south. Because he was a simple farmer. He didn't have any idea about geography. He said, yeah, you go to Australia. It's how far? It's a long way. You know, it's just, what is it, from Bangkok, a 7-8 hour, maybe 7 hour flight. Wow, it's a long way. Yeah, and if you keep going further, you go to Antarctica. What's that like? Is there any Thai people there? No, it's all ice and, was it penguins or something? It's just ice there. It's really ice everywhere, because he couldn't really imagine that. Ice everywhere. And so anyway, we just mentioned that to him. And the following morning, he said, you were right. What do you mean you were right? If you go down really south, you've got this place, it's just got ice and snow everywhere. So he let on to us that he just got into his mind made body and just gone over there to check it out, see if we were right. So that's a pretty good monk. You can just go off to ice to Antarctica if you really want to. If you get bored here, you know, you don't know what to do in the evening. If this isn't cold enough for you, can go to Antarctica overnight. Anyway, so he was a really good monk, and that's all he ever did, just walking and sitting. So that's the best thing to do, is if it gets you get quiet and peaceful in your walking meditation, just walk back into this room, sit down, cross your legs, and take it deeper into meditation, deep into the jhanas. Because it's much better to be sitting down if you want to get into deep meditations rather than walking. How to bring joy into meditation, and what stage? Is it before body awareness or after watching breath? Thanks, Ajahn. Well, I do that from the really beginning. Sometimes, when do you bring joy when you start eating? When you look at the food, yeah, look at that food. Yeah, it's my favorite food. Yeah, people are so kind to me. Oh, yeah. You bring joy up. And that's actually good for your digestion. If you know, think of your favorite food now. I'm torturing you, aren't I? Shouldn't talk about food in the evening talks. But if you think about it, then saliva comes out of your mouth. If you don't enjoy the food, your digestion doesn't go very well. Saliva, bile, all this other stuff which has to come out of your system to digest the food doesn't come out. So that's one of the reasons why, even when you are meditating, I usually start this, I look forward to meditating, but when I go through the body, and just I relax the body with kindness and mindfulness, and then after a while, the body feels good. I've developed the perception of joy on my body when I relax. It feels really nice, especially now because I'm getting old. Sorry, I made a mistake there. I am old. I'm not getting old. But sometimes when you're older, you just get more aches and pains in the body. It's stiffer. It doesn't sort of bend or jump up as quickly as it did in the old days. But it does mean that you can feel the body, and it's usually got an ache or a pain somewhere. It's hot, it's cold, or whatever. But when you relax the body, every time I do that bodily relaxation, the body feels delightful. There's a pleasure there almost every time. And so I notice that pleasure of relaxation. And once you notice the pleasure of relaxation of the body, you realize that's nothing much to do with the body. It's very much how your mind observes the body. That's one of the reasons I told that story this morning about the most beautiful feces in the world. Feces aren't beautiful. Bamboo in a place where it shouldn't be planted is not beautiful. It's just the mind, which is so powerful. You can see beauty in anything. And that's what happens. So you develop, this happens naturally, whether you like it or not, whether you want it or you don't want it, you start to see more beauty, more delight in things you never thought could ever be beautiful. And with things like the breath, wow, it soon becomes very, very joyful, very, very wonderful. So it's not exactly what you do. If you do have difficulty developing the joy in the meditation, then just one thing which my teacher told me when I was a layman, he said, when you get up in the morning, what's the first thing you do? I was a student. I said, just get out and go to the toilet. Great! In the washroom, is there a mirror? I said, yeah, of course there is. And he said, well, when you get up, look at your face in the mirror and smile. And that's why I said, sir, I'm a student. I stay up late at night, get up into all sorts of naughty things. And when I get up in the morning, it's impossible to smile. student, if you've got a son or someone young you look at him in the morning, you haven't got any energy at that time in the morning, especially if you have to go to school. I haven't told that joke yet, have I? About the mum, some of you know this joke, but he said, how do you make people laugh or have some joy and happiness? A bit of fun and games in the evening is really useful. There was, sometimes children just don't like getting up in the morning to go to school. So anyway, a mother had a son who never liked getting up in the morning to go to school. And so she went to his bedroom, knocked on his door and said, son, get up, you've got to go to school. But mummy, I don't like school. But son, you have to go to school. Mummy, give me one good reason why I want to go to school. The other kids don't like me, the teachers don't like me, no one likes me at school. Give me one good reason why I should get up and go to school. Son, because you're the principal, the headmaster. I haven't heard that one, that's good. Now, because you've got laughter in there, if you just close your eyes right now and meditated, you'd have that perception of joy at the very beginning and the permission to allow joy to come up in meditation. It makes meditation much easier. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, I tell some funny stories. It makes you pay more attention to the talk. As one Tibetan monk used to say, every time he told a joke, when people had their mouths open, that's when he could put in the pill of Dhamma. Otherwise, they'd be thinking about something else. So that joy in the meditation, as early as you like, it's going to come up anyway, whether you like it or not. When you choose to or not, the meditation becomes blissful and beautiful. So be prepared for that. When it comes, welcome it. The other thing to do is, so go and smile at yourself in the mirror in the morning. If you're having a difficult time, that's one of the best methods of overcoming depression. Look at your face in the morning. So I did that, as my teacher said, look at my face in the mirror. And if I failed, I told him, look, I can't do that in the morning. He said, get your two fingers, come on, two fingers, side of the mouth, push up. Okay. You've got to take your mask off, first of all, to do that, because I can't see otherwise. You go, it's okay. But these days, you know, people say, Ajahn Brahm, look, you're putting on weight, you should do more exercise. And I complained to them. I said, look, I do exercise. I do 10 push-ups every morning. Do you do any push-ups in the morning? I do. One, two, three, four. I exercise my smiley muscles, so they're much easier. And the last thing about how to create more joy is to know the benefits of it. It's really worthwhile. And I learned this when I was... Okay, I told you that I was a bit of a naughty student. They had all these clubs and societies you could join. And one of those societies, I don't know how I got myself into this, was the boat club. You know, these boats on the river, and you just pull these oars and go in these races and race Oxford and stuff like that. It's the only reason I got it, it's only just at the college level, that they were offering this, okay, I'll admit it, free, I think it was claret. And really nice stuff. And in those days, you know, stupid student, I gave up alcohol when I was at... a student, I saw the stupidity in it. But at the time, you know, whatever I could have, if it was free, I'd have it. And I must have taken too many glasses of that wine because I found I'd signed up for the boat club. That's how they got their members. And anyway, so I gave it a try. But one of the nice things about that, which I would always... be thankful for. I was in one of these races, and you know, it was a close race, so you had to keep on rowing and rowing as hard as you could. And then the coach was on the tow bank, you know, the bank alongside the River Cam, and he shouted out at us. He shouted out at me. He said, my lane name was Peter. Peter, you're making an ugly face. Smile. And of course you're making an ugly face. You're pushing that blooming oar as hard as you could. And it was really hard work. He said, you're making an ugly face, smile. But one of the things I had at that time, I was always inquisitive, willing to give anything a try just to see what happened. So I smiled. And then you had this amazing sort of insight about what happened. Because then you had more energy to pull that oar. It was weird. That when you were grimacing, trying to pull it, you didn't have much strength. As soon as you smiled, the strength came back again. and you enjoyed it. And that actually taught me a big lesson. If you are having some sort of operation, and it's only local anesthetic, please smile when they're doing that to you. This is going to hurt a bit. It's not that you're being a masochist. You ladies, if ever you're pregnant, have a baby, then please smile when it's coming out. Because it actually changes the psychology of it. Whatever you have to do, everything becomes much easier, much higher quality. And that's one of the things which surprised me. That's one of the reasons why I value smiling. You have to give a talk to many people. Oh, and some of those talks which I give, a huge number of people, and go into the hall, I've given so many talks, I haven't got a clue what I'm going to talk about. What happens if, you know, people throw things at me? When I started thinking like that, I suddenly realized why in Buddhist talks you're not allowed to wear shoes. You get it, in case the monk gives a bad talk. All you can throw at me is the teddy bears, and I won't mind that. So when you value that smile, then it's easier to allow that joy to come up. It's what you value. It makes it much easier. But it's going to come anyway, whether you like it or not, as I say. Good evening, Ajahn Brahm. You said, look, I said so many things in my life. So whatever you quote here, I did say it somewhere, sometime in all these times I've given talks. You said that being present in the now is a basis of mindfulness. Fair enough. But it's so difficult to be in the now, is it? That perception of it being difficult, it's pretty easy, especially here. Where else do you want to be? You are here. So be mindful of where you are. And the other thing about, I should read out the whole question first. I'm convinced of its value, but can't seem to stay here and now in meditation for long. Help. Thank you, Ajahn. Easy. Once the present moment starts to feel good, it's easy to stay there. Look, in the old days, I remember when you used to have a TV, you'd actually surf through the channels. Actually, when I grew up, it was very easy. You only had two channels to surf through. You know, when you grew up, you had BBC and ITV in London. But my goodness, we almost had wars to the death about which one we had to put on. I don't know how you manage with all these other, so many channels. Okay, another interesting story. Totally off. Anyway, this is true. There was this Thai couple who come to our temple often. They bought a new house. It was haunted, had a ghost. And they found out many things. But one of the things which was irritating to them, they have a TV, a nice TV, and they're watching their program, and it would suddenly just turn over to another channel. They never touched the remote control, it just did it by itself. So they thought, I don't know why, there must be some electrical interference or something, so they got the remote control and turned it back to their channel, and a minute or two later it would turn back again. And they were just so frustrated. But there was evidence of another ghost activity in the house, so they concluded this must be like the ghost, the former owner of the house, who preferred watching the channel which he liked rather than what they liked. And be careful, because these spirits, they're not harmful. They know how to use electricity. I don't know how they do it. And so whatever channel they want, they get. So they solved the problem easily. And actually did this. They bought another TV set. One was for them, one for the ghost. And then they had harmony. It's an obvious solution. But I was saying that because once you have a channel which you like, or a movie or documentary which you like, if you like it, you're going to stay with that for a long time. Half an hour, hour and a half. Why? Because it's interesting and you like it. If it's boring or you've seen it before, oh, this is same old rubbish, of course you go flipping the switches to get another channel. And that's actually what you do with your mind. You just flip the switches. What's going on? What's going on in the ear channel? Who's talking? What's going on in the sight channel? What can I sort of entertain myself with? What's going on in the bodily feeling channel? Maybe I can scratch this. That's really nice. That's interesting. Scratch over here. And all of these different things trying to entertain yourself. But if you really like what you're doing, if you like the present moment and have some joy in it, it's very easy to stay there. It's not just seeing its value, it's seeing its pleasure in being present. And look, it shouldn't be that hard to realize. You know, all of you, you just work so hard. You do so much. So much you have to plan. I know that. It was before I just came in here, I mean, not today, on Friday, just so much, so much things to decide and do and stuff. And you come here, okay, that's over in Bodhinyana Monastery. I didn't go there today, so except for lunch. But I can just stay here and just... This is my, freedom. This is where I escape to. So I'm happy here. That's beautiful, being here. So when you are away from all of these things, I appreciate it. And you see the joy in the present moment. If you want to have problems with the past and the future, with the past and the future, in order to let them go, this I haven't said this yet, but it's important, be kind to your past. Don't just try and sort of squash it, hide it somewhere so I can't see it. Don't try and hide anything. Just acknowledge it and give it as much kindness as you can. Whatever you did, all the stuff which you feel guilty about, give yourself amnesty. Don't be such a hard judge on yourself. I'm not a hard judge of all that stupid things I did as a lay person, going out, getting drunk. What else did I do? You know, one of the things which I was always... I shouldn't really be embarrassed about this. It was actually good fortune. That, once my girlfriend invited me out for dinner. She knew I was a vegetarian at that time, but she made me a meat dish. And I was really upset. I said, I'm not eating that. That's meat. And that was the end of that relationship. It's actually good because, otherwise I wouldn't become a monk. But nevertheless, I felt really guilty at the time. She'd never do that. Just eat it and then tell her afterwards. She put so much effort into making that food for me and I just refused it. I felt awful about things like that. But then afterwards, you forgive yourself. You're trying your best. You're not perfect. When I'm kind to my past, I can let it go. And when other people, what they did to you, be kind to them as well. Forgiveness is beautiful. There's all these amazing acts of forgiveness which I've seen in this world. People who forgive, one of those amazing ones is in Auschwitz. This lady, she was just such a young girl when the Jewish people were being rounded up. She had a twin sister, an identical twin. And because of that, they were kept alive in Auschwitz so Dr. Mengele could experiment on them. And they choose, the one that experiment on and the one who would be the control of any experiment. She was fortunate she was the control, but even that, just they really hurt her. But, she had to witness her twin sister being experimented on and just treated just so cruelly, tortured. And you can imagine what that does to you. But then later on in her life, she found out that one of the, not the main doctors, but one of the assistant doctors who was there, she traced him down to Argentina somewhere. And by that time, she realized the anger just made things so much worse. So she wrote this letter to him and asked him to meet her in the grounds of Auschwitz. and when they met together in the ground of Auschwitz, you know, she could have just let the authorities know he'd been arrested and put in jail. But instead, she said to him, in the grounds of Auschwitz, you know, I'm that little girl, and you know, you killed my sister, and well, I forgive you. I have no ill will against you. Please forgive yourself too. And she did, and then she wrote about it afterwards in the news, and the fact that that's what she could do, you can forgive something like that, was brilliant. And what she wrote, I remember, was, now I'm not a victim anymore. I'm a victor. I beat that. So forgiveness is incredible. It frees you. So if you've got anything from the past which you regret, either what happened to you by someone else or what you did, please give that as much kindness as you can. And the most wonderful type of kindness is the forgiveness. Forgive not just what you did, but what other people did as well. It's just all this cause and effect process, which sometimes people, they regret what they did, but why did they do it? They're in a situation which they didn't really have too much choice. So forgive it. Then you can let it go. You learn from it. You don't punish yourself from it. And the same with the future. The future. If you think too much about, how do you think of the future? Do you think, oh my goodness, one day already gone, I can't stand this any longer. I haven't got any jhanas yet. I haven't got any psychic powers. Oh, this is hopeless. I just come in here another day sitting on this cushion. This is like torture. So no, be kind to this moment. Be kind to yourself. If you're tired, give yourself a rest, for goodness sake. I keep saying that, and sometimes people feel guilty about it. You feel you're being lazy. Look, you're not, you're being kind. Now, there was one of these stories from the suttas. Now, the Buddha took a rest. After lunch, it was a hot season, he got really tired, and so he lay down, go to sleep. And then this Mara came up to him and said, yeah, look at you. You think you're enlightened, a Buddha, and you're taking the rest. There's people working right now. Farmers are working hard to get the food to feed you. And you're just sleeping. You call yourself a Buddha. You're hopeless. Why are you sleeping for? So what he said was, I'm sleeping for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. And that really shook me. Because that's what you do it for, if you're going to do it properly. So, if you're late one morning when you're going to work, and the boss says, where were you? I said, I was sleeping. Why? For the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. And that could be true. Making an example of kindness to your own body, which needs it. Anyway, this is what I've heard. So anyway, after a while, you find you can be kind to the future, kind to the past, and it's not so heavy anymore. It's much easier to let go. It's like diluting its weight on you when you're kind to it. And then you're really kind to this present moment. This moment is here for you. Please respect it and be kind to it. And then it's easy to stay in this moment. Be kind to your breath. Breath, I don't know what you want to do, but how you want to do it. Then come in and go out, in long or short, whatever you need. Now my job is just to make sure everything is convenient and happy for you, Mr. Breath. And that's how it works. And anyway, it's only the first day in meditation. After a while, you can stay in this present moment pretty easily. Especially when the joy comes up. Anyway, you mentioned that sometimes the people you think cannot get good meditation end up having them, and vice versa. My question is related to this. Well, I think whoever wrote this question obviously can't get good meditation. I don't know. Why is it that a person who is quite virtuous, selfless, extremely kind and gentle, by their own admission, do not have great meditations? And a person who seems at the outset at least grumpy, moody at times, has a big ego and can be manipulative at times, to get their own way, can get good meditation? Are you talking about me? Is it that we see only one side of these people? Yeah. What's really going on? A lot of times you do see only one side of the people. Sometimes people look virtuous, but one of the reasons why they don't get good meditation is they're control freaks. This is the alms bowl which I have. It was given to me by this monk. It's a French monk who looked the perfect monk. Always really virtuous, always come to the meditation hall, you know, on time. And when we did the all-night meditations, he was always sit perfectly straight. And he didn't speak very much. So a lot of his fellow monks, including me, thought, wow, that's a really, really good monk. He's probably really close to enlightenment if he's not there already. And after 3 or 4 years, he disrobed. And that kind of shook me. You know, he disrobed. What has been going on? And then he let on. Because, you know, he spent a long time with me in a couple of monasteries, that we used to do these all-night sittings once a week. And sometimes I had a good meditation, but often he was nodding, sloth and torpor. And he would never nod. And he only told me after he disrobed, he said, sometimes during those all-night meditations, he said, I opened my eyes and I looked at you, Ajahn Brahm, half asleep, and I was jealous. I wish I could do that, he said. He was so afraid of what other people thought of him. He could not let go. He was control freak monk. And there's many I've seen like that. They're afraid of making mistakes, afraid of what other people think of them. Look at my robes. I'm not afraid what other people think of me. You relax to the max. That's one of the reasons I say that, relax to the max. It doesn't matter what other people think of you. So anyway, those are the sort of people, they look good on the outside, they look virtuous, but where's their virtue coming from? Fear that they make a mistake, fear they'll be found out, fear that something they did will cause offence to somebody. It's nice to be restrained, it's good to be virtuous, but that virtue has to come from a natural place of goodness and kindness, not trying to show off. So anyway, those are the people who get the nice meditations, the ones who can let go, who don't control. This meditation is not an ego attainment. It happens when your sense of self disappears. Now, I emphasize that, stress that. The more that you are there, the less peace you'll have in your meditation. When you vanish, it becomes a natural process. You're just watching, not doing anything. Meditation gets blissful. I've said this many times before, and I say this to answer a question, but also to give, like, a powerful Dhamma. You know that sometimes people always like to find out or ask. Like when I was in Indonesia, Handaka was always on to me, Ajahn Brahm, are you an arahat yet? Have you got any psychic powers? Can you show us? And can you actually, Ajahn Brahm, come on, confess. All these jhanas you talk about, can you do them? And so, you know, just I've been saying this for a while now. I said, look, Ajahn Brahm, I'm honest with you. Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. Is this recorded? It's on video? Ajahn Brahm can't attain jhana. How can I talk so much about it? Am I a hypocrite? No. Whenever I give answers like that, you know there's always something tricky going on underneath. Ajahn Brahm has to vanish, first of all, has to disappear. That sense of self and the doer, which is an important part of that sense of self, has to vanish. When that disappears, then the jhanas happen. You don't do them. You stop doing. You're still, peaceful. And then the jhanas happen. And I say that not concerned about Ajahn Brahm. Say that for you. So the more you vanish and disappear, the less you do. That's why you don't count these like as an attainment. You don't attain them. You let go and this is what happens. It's a powerful Dhamma point. I hope you can appreciate that. There were some times in the Christian tradition there did seem to be two or three people like Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross. This was, I think, 13th century or something, a long time ago. They seemed to have the ability to enter a jhana. How? Even in the Christian Bible, there's, I think it's in the Psalms somewhere, be still and know that thou art God. That's powerful. And to know that, you know, you identify as God, and through stillness, and I can see what happens. Because sometimes in that tradition, what do, these hermits, these ascetics, or these monks, nuns, they renounce themselves, their will, they give up everything, and they say, let God take over. They let go of their sense of self. They never do this. This is what happens when they disappear. Okay, now there's a lot of wrong things about that view, but nevertheless you can understand how it works. When you sacrifice yourself, this is not what you achieve. It's what happens when you stop all this achieving business. Okay, next question. How do we get rid of guilt from our past actions where we did not treat people well? These moments, thoughts appear during meditation. Does guilt ever help you? If you are guilty, the trouble with guilt is that once a person is pronounced guilty in court, you have a hammer, you go, bang, you're guilty. What happens next? Sentence. And the story I love, now, these are true stories. This young Anagarika candidate, you know, he came. He didn't know too much about Buddhism, but nevertheless, he told him about the eight precepts. The eight precepts: you don't have anything to eat in the afternoon, evening, nighttime, until the following morning. So he came to see me one morning. He said, "I never slept last night. I feel so bad. I feel so guilty." I said, "What do you do?" He said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, but last night I was so hungry. I snuck into the kitchen and made myself a sandwich and ate it. I broke my precepts." And I said, "Okay, thank you for letting me know. Now, please try and eat more at lunchtime. You know, have more to eat. And if you are hungry in the evening, crikey, the amount of stuff which, you know, gets past the line, you can eat cheese, chocolate. You can have orange juice, apple juice, honey. My goodness, there's so much you can eat anyway. It may not be like a sandwich, but there's so much other stuff you have. So have some of that if you really get hungry, okay?" So I gave him some advice on what to do next time he is hungry. He doesn't have to make himself a sandwich. And he said, "Oh, that's very good, thank you. But," I said, "you can go now." He said, "Is that it? Aren't you going to throw me out? Aren't you going to punish me?" And I said, "No, we don't do punishment in Buddhist monasteries." And that's when he said, "Ajahn Brahm, look, I know my character. You have to give me some sort of punishment. Otherwise I'll do it again. That's how I've been conditioned, grown up. Do something wrong, you get punished, and that will help you not do it again." So the theory goes. It doesn't actually help you not do it again. It just helps you be more smart next time and not get caught. You become more sneaky. And so I said, "Well, you really want a punishment?" And he said, "Yeah." Okay. And I'd just been reading a book about Australians' early history, when if anybody did any sort of crime or misdeed, they got whipped. And I had this really evil type of whip called the Cat of Nine Tails. You heard that before in Australia? Cat of Nine Tails. So I told him, and said, "Okay, if you want a punishment, I will give you 50 strokes of the cat." And this poor guy, you can see the Adigavikas, they wear white. His face meant more white than his clothes. He really thought I was going to flog him. And then I told him what 50 strokes of the cat mean in a Buddhist monastery. We had two cats at that time. One was called Kit Kat, the other one was called Mitt Kat. So find one of them, 50 strokes. One, two, three. Stroke the cat 50 times. Learn some compassion and kindness. That's your punishment. He got it afterwards and he understood what you meant. We don't have punishment which you're afraid of, but just a little method of having more kindness so you can forgive yourself as you forgive others. That's how you get rid of guilt from your past action where you did not treat people well. Learn some more compassion. So whoever wrote this, if this keeps happening, appear during your meditation. We don't have cats here, but we do have teddy bears. So it depends on how bad it was. Either 50 strokes of the teddy bear or 100. Okay, when you're doing this, remember why you're doing it. Learn some more kindness. Then it's easy to let go of guilt. "Please, could I borrow a 1 litre water bottle or any other 1 litre container with a lid?"
"I didn't know it was your box."
"Oh, my box, okay."
"I wrote for the manager."
The answer, of course, is yes. Whatever we can to look after each other. Goodness gracious. Okay, this is not a question, this is an essay. Okay, grateful for Ajahn Brahm's words, cannot express the gratitude. If someone did something really, really, really stupid about 20 years ago, that probably hurt someone else, and they're completely forgiven themselves, given $100 to a relevant charity, and are generally on good terms with the person, but that person was a partner and children, and it doesn't feel right to contact them to apologize and ask how to make amends. How can one lessen or completely eliminate the bad karma of the act and parent and bid and a bad rebirth? Seeing that the five khandhas are completely conditioned, impermanent, suffering and non-self, including the will that choose the stupid, unskillful act? Helps tremendously." Okay. "Any skills, perspective, wisdom at the..." Oh, quirky. "Attitudes, compassion to share so there is complete peace of mind and freedom from fear. The defilements have been severely lessened, but fear is the one that still arises, the majority of suffering these days, even though the truth is that fear is just feeling which is equally conditioned, impermanent suffering and non-self. So it is not me, not a self. And by not getting involved, it just vanishes." Yeah? So much love for the kindness, compassion, wisdom we refer to as Ajahn Brahm. Okay. Yeah, if someone has done something really bad which hurts another person, what we do is to give it meaning. we learn from it. And the more you learn from it, just the more you realize its value. You've hurt other people, but they have an opportunity to learn as well. And so it's, and again, after many, many years, we do forget these things. So that's the best you can do. You learn, you grow, and become much better. Just because you did a bad thing doesn't make you a bad person. Every time I go in prisons, or not to do time, but to go and teach, I'm not a bad monk. When you go into the jails and teach, that's how you teach. Some of the people in jail have done some terrible things. But you teach them just to put it in perspective. That's not the only thing you've done. And just up the road in Carnap Prison Farm, there was this one guy, the other monks go there every Friday evening. I think Venerable Radha went there yesterday night. And there's one person in there, he's in there for murder. But he's not a murderer. He actually did those two murders, he says. But then he's going around telling everybody, he read that simile of the two bad bricks in the wall. So it was only two murders. Only two murders. Doesn't make me a murderer. Does it? And now he's seeing the two stupid mistakes he made. You'll never do that ever again. But of course that took people's lives and sort of hurt their families. But that's the best you can do. Just learn from it so you never have to do that ever again. When you make mistakes, please forgive them. Put them in perspective. There's so many other beautiful things which you can do. And I have to tell this story too. These days we have people bringing food in to you. Like today, a few of the Thai people, like Mon and her friends, and Ambert. Oh, what's the other one? Marie. She's Vietnamese and Laotian. But she works so hard. They made the food for you today. But in those days, some time ago, we'd have a cook would do the cooking for us. Remember when Bianca used to do the cooking as well as managing the retreat? She was an amazing lady. She made such beautiful food. But then when her partner got cancer, she couldn't do that a job anymore. So we had to hire somebody or get a volunteer to do the cooking. There's some lovely cooks here. Once at this place over in North Perth, we had this young Anagara called Trung, now known as Ajahn Santuti. And I don't know if any of you remember that time when he was cooking. You know, he has such a beautiful smile on his face. And he was cooking woks and just frying everything up. And many Singaporeans who came on our retreat, they would actually go to the kitchen just to look at him. And he would just smile and just cook and stuff. He was just so efficient and so much fun to watch. And of course, the food was really delicious because the amount of fun and joy he had when he was cooking it. But I did better than that one year here. We were looking for a cook and we couldn't find one to cook for the retreatants. But we actually found one. His name was Carl. He's an excellent cook and he worked really hard. And at the end of the retreat, when we showed gratitude for everybody, you know, he was not there. So they asked me, just were all the people who helped you in this retreat to organize it, look after you, retreat managers, where's Carl gone? And so I said, okay, I think I'll let you know now that Carl was on work release from Carnap Prison Farm up the road. He was in there for rape. You can see everybody go really quiet. You didn't need to have psychic powers to read their thoughts. You mean, Ajahn Brahm, you let a rapist come and cook for us? And, you know, we chopped up his vegetables, you know, in the kitchen and spoke to him. Ajahn Brahm, he was a prisoner. And you let him into our retreat? And then I said, what was he like? Oh, he's so much fun. We trusted him so much. He's a great guy. He said, yeah, he did those crimes under drugs when he was young. Had a very long sentence. And now he's coming to the end of it. And I trusted him. I knew him very well of this. There's no way in the world he would ever harm any one of you. And it's a wonderful thing to give him that opportunity to serve and do something wonderful and good. And for each one of the people who are there to realize how we can judge way too unfairly. He was a lovely fellow. He did a lot of good service. He never charged for anything. He gave his time for free, and he was a wonderful fellow. So, Nolia, where are you from? Robin. No, these are all, they've got good families, they're not prisoners. But it's a beautiful thing, that, and he thanked everybody for giving him that trust to come here, and he did such a good job. So that's a beautiful thing to be able to do. Yeah, it's sometimes people have done terrible things in the past, but that does not make them a terrible person. Just because you failed one exam, that doesn't make you a failure. Anyway, next question. My brother does Kundalini yoga, and he feels energy from his brain towards Muldara. What does that mean? Muldara. Anyway, wherever. Does it mean anything? Did the Buddha say anything about it? I don't think the Buddha said too much about that type of meditation, but I know that sometimes you get energies in your body when you're meditating, but those energies are much better if they don't go into your body, but actually go into your mind where they belong. They fit much better. So after a while when you're meditating, your body starts to relax and starts to disappear, you get into peace and stillness, you can see the breath and becomes very beautiful, very energized. You should be letting go of your body by that time and have no perception of it. So it doesn't go to any chakra, it just goes into your mind, into the sixth sense, and doesn't go into the fifth sense. Then it's much safer, more powerful, more beneficial in so many ways. But when it goes into the body, sometimes it just really disturbs people. Can't sleep at night, and also they have health problems as well. So as a Buddhist meditator, please, if you get that type of energy coming up, please take away all your perceptions of the body and just allow it to stay in your mind. Don't let it leak out. It's far more healthy, far more powerful and beneficial. Can one get enlightened and afterwards regret it? No. And I will let you know. If you get enlightened on this retreat and you regret it, you can ask for your money back from this retreat and every other donation you've ever given in your whole life. That's how confident you are. If you really are, you don't regret anything. My goodness, it's like you're free. Like somebody just dragged you out of a dung pit. Would you regret that? Anyway, no. Do you believe it to be a true consciousness? AI. Artificial intelligence. Do you believe it to be a true consciousness? If not, why not? How would it affect the human condition? I don't know. I'm only a monk. I'm not a cyber one. Sometimes it's a fascinating concept, but it can be that a consciousness can develop in, say, AI, but that consciousness has to come from somewhere else. The consciousness, which is on the stream of consciousness, as the Buddha said, which goes into a human body, is imperfect. So if artificial intelligence becomes a stream of consciousness, it will be imperfect too. It will make mistakes, do wrong things. That's the nature of the stream of consciousness, all consciousnesses. They're not perfect. Once they become perfect, they're enlightened, they don't get reborn again. You know that, I think Christina is out there. If you're out there, Christina, that little box, that Nibbana box, to be auctioned for my birthday, yeah, please, I'll be very interested in receiving that again. You showed it to me, but you haven't given it to me yet. But that Nibbana box is this little box, and people don't know what it is. It's just a box. It's got one switch on the top. You turn the switch on, and then something goes on inside, and then the part of the top of the box, half the lid goes up, a little hand comes out, and it turns the switch off, and then goes back inside and closes up. And that's the end of it. It's a box which, once you switch it on, it switches itself off. And that's a beautiful simile for Nibbana. You switch yourself on so many lifetimes ago, and now you come here and eventually you switch yourself off. And that's the end of you, Parinibbana. Do you understand that? One day you will. So AI, that's like an artificial intelligence box. You just need someone to switch it on, and then it switches itself off. Actually, we can change its name to an AI Nibbana box. But if you are afraid and have fear, then of course you can make up all sorts of scenarios where artificial intelligence will take over the world. Maybe it already has. Maybe Ajahn Brahm. No, I came from Cambridge. Maybe I was an artificial intelligence, one of the first ones. Because if it's real artificial intelligence, no one would know it. It will disguise itself so perfectly that you would think it's just an ordinary human being. Look at those nuns. So don't be afraid. Hello and good evening, Ajahn Brahm. You describe the peace and beauty of meditation. Could you speak to when it is hard? Pain, restlessness, emotions that are uncomfortable when fear arises. When those things happen, the type of meditation which I always recommend is called the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. It's actually what you do all the time, but it's just focusing on one particular part of the meditation technique, which makes it very easy. Emperor's Three Questions: when is the most important time? Who is the most important person? I've got different answers. Some people said themselves, that's wrong. Is it Ajahn Brahm? No. Is it your wife? The most important person is the one right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. That's you right now, sir. But not for long. Now it's you. Now it's you. In other words, the thing which you're aware of in meditation, that's the most important thing in the whole world, whatever it is. And the third question, what's the most important thing to do? And the most important thing to do is to care. Not to cure, not to improve, not to change, but just to care for it. And that's such a powerful teaching. So if you are really in a lot of pain, you know, you're really restless all over the place in your meditation. Number one, just you're with your body first of all. Please care for your body. Don't just go sitting down there and just trying to beat it down and conquer it. Just go and find a nice quiet place in your room and lay down on the bed, have a cup of tea or coffee or whatever, and just lay down. Try and get your body as comfortable as possible. If it's like a headache, I mean, I'm sure we've got some Panadol or aspirin or something somewhere here. If it's some sort of fever, you know, just tell the people here and get some sort of medical attention. And so you're being kind to your body and make those feelings your meditation object. People say they've got pain, they can't meditate. Of course you can meditate all the time, 100% of the time. You can't always meditate on your breath, but you're aware of something. Whatever you're aware of, that's what you watch. When it's beautiful, opening the door of your heart to it, the kindness. So you can give it that care, that kindness. And it's amazing just how much of the pain, the negativity disappears. Because what you're doing, you're dealing with the reaction to that negativity. Instead of trying to cure it and get rid of it and think, how long is this going to last? I can't stand this any longer. Care for it. And it's really remarkable when you do that, just how the negativity, the impossibility of enjoying another moment of this tends to vanish. At least it lessens a lot. Okay, I have to say that it fits in. This was the story of the when I developed food poisoning. Have you ever had food poisoning, really bad food poisoning? Where you just have these spasms in your stomach. And the spasms, the stomach contracts, and it's so painful. So when I had food poisoning, I would call that for monks and nuns an occupational hazard. Sometimes I don't know where the food comes from. People say it's good for you, it's good for them, but maybe not good for me. But anyway, I was in my cave, felt terrible. And every now and again, I usually do this to to wake people up. But that's what it sounded like. It was just involuntary. You have these spasms, and they're really, really painful. And because I was in my cave, no one could hear me. That's the trouble with the cave. It's supposed to be designed so I can't hear them when they need me. And now, the downside of that, they can't hear me. So I was in the cave and just really just suffering. And I thought, well, I should maybe just crawl to the door and open it and crawl out and just... But, you know, that's really hopeless because by the time you call the ambulance, just like the police say, where are you? Ah! A monastery. Ah! Where's that? Ah! And by the time they get here, just you're dead. So that's not worth it. So I decided what I'd teach each one of you, just to meditate. And there was a wonderful experience which I will never forget, just really in quite extreme pain. And then just, instead of trying to get rid of it, I knew the next contraction was going to come soon, the next spasm was going to be painful, but just be kind to it, let it be. Open the door of your heart to it. And so you did that, and the next time that spasm came, it was the most important thing in the world to me, obviously. But I was just kind to it. And because you're aware of it, letting it be, you can have full awareness of it instead of trying to shrink away from it, you did notice it got less painful. Only a tiny bit. Every spasm got less intense. It took me half an hour. It could be 40 minutes, but it took about half an hour to 40 minutes. And then the spasms just got so painless. It was just, the whole problem disappeared. There was no more food poisoning. You cured it yourself. The ambulance wouldn't have come by now if he could have called it. Just it disappeared by itself. There's the power of mindfulness and kindness. So if you are in a very difficult state of mind and or state of body, what are you aware of right now, right in this moment, and care for it? You'd be surprised how powerful that is. Don't try and get something. If you go off into the future, that's where a lot of the stress comes from. Instead, just be in this moment. You learn so much, it's precious. Anyway, next question. Thank you for this experience. Jhana Grove is so blissful. Yeah, I agree with that. Ajahn, what should happen once all the thoughts disappears? Find out. There are moments when the thoughts stop and the breath is so light. Great. It is beautiful. But I'm not sure what to do next. Come on, I've told you so many times. There is no next. What to do? You do nothing. You got this light and it's beautiful. Enjoy. Instead of trying to do something, okay, I got here, where do I go next? You go nowhere, stay where you are. Go deeper inside of it. Don't try and get something else. Something else will come by itself when you stop doing things, when you disappear some more. That's good. Anyway, so when these things happen, there is no next. Present moment awareness and enjoy to the max where you already are. Don't do anything. You know, a lot of times to get deeper into meditation, it's what, not what you do, but what you don't do. It's like restraint of the senses, restraint of the doer. Stay still. Don't do anything. Don't go anywhere. Don't change anything. Just stay put. It develops by itself. Okay. You still okay? It's 8:30 now. What time am I supposed to finish? Is it 10:30, wasn't it? Now just go for a few more minutes. I myself, along with several friends, would like to become a monastic, but only as a monk. Unfortunately, in this lifetime we are all trapped in a female body. Why do we have the sensibility? Why do we have the sensibility? Please clarify. Okay, I can't understand the bottom, but this is the next thing about people who are trans ordaining. We've already got a few candidates, people who are trans, who want to ordain as monks or nuns. There's no real objection to that at all. No, years ago, that there was, even it was supposed to be illegal in Thailand, not in the Vinaya, illegal in Thailand if you were gay to ordain as a monk. But we had these wonderful homosexual supporters of our monasteries, you know, good meditators, they come on the retreats, they were very virtuous. And so, you know, after a while, I said, well, what's wrong with ordaining these? So we did it. I remember just asking, I won't tell you who this monk is, you probably guess. But anyway, that I just asked him, I said, well, what would happen to you if, you know, because this is a group of men in the monastery, if like a really hot guy came in and you really liked him, what would you do? He said, I'll just go to my room and just lay down and just manage to suppress that, because I really want to be a monk. I don't want to have any more homosexual relationships. Okay, fine. So I let him stay as an anagarika, then as a novice monk, then as a full monk, and now he's an ajahn. And it's a wonderful decision. So a lot of time you give people a chance and they live up to it. So after ordaining gay people as really good monks, the next thing was people with psychological problems, schizophrenics. And there's one guy, I'm really proud of this guy, and this one guy, he was a clinical schizophrenic on clozapine, and but he had mindfulness. He really was aware of himself, and he was honest. His virtue was brilliant. And so I remember when I gave him a chance as an anagarika to stay here. I remember coming up to me one day and said, look, Ajahn Brahm, I'm losing it. I need to go into the hospital to get my medication balanced. So he went away for 2 or 3 days to get his medication balanced. And he had such mindfulness and honesty, you could trust him 100%. And eventually ordained him as a novice monk, ordained him as a full monk. And he too is like a senior monk now. And the lovely thing about this guy, that none of you would know who he is. Brilliant, brilliant man. And it's amazing, you can't, not all schizophrenics can be good monks or good nuns, but some can. Give them a chance. So the next challenge, you know, for our communities is for the trans community. And so because this is what we've done so far, of course we'll find some means, some way of getting that possibility for you. So as long as you fit into the monastery, people like you, then of course, why not? You can stay. And then ordain. Be a monk or a nun, whichever gender you you identify with. To me it's just obvious, if it can be done, it should be done. I don't know if you've got any objections to that, but I think that's only fair. I don't mean waiting in your next life. No, do it now. Now is the most important time. The gender right in front of you when you look at yourself, who you think you are, who you identify, that's the most important gender for you. And the only thing to do is to care. Consistent. After a recent meditation, my mind was slow enough to notice the eye-making process. In this case, hunger sensation led to sankhara labeled this hungry, sankhara labeled this I'm hungry. Before this, I still had a sense of the self as something solid, but now I see it as a habit. Do you have any advice for me at this stage of practice? Yeah, carry on, you're doing well. So if you're seeing that, after a while, you don't identify so much with these little labels. And that's how sankhara works, through labeling. Dear Arjuna, if someone dies unexpectedly, like in a sudden car crash or stroke, or when in a deep sleep state, what happens to the consciousness? Would this person know it is dead, or do they become a wandering ghost? If it's unexpectedly, a lot of times people die unexpectedly. Every now and again, obviously, that the doctors say you've only got a few days to live. Or like that person who was told by the doctor, he's really, really sick. He said, how long have I got to live? And the doctor replied, 10. And the patient said, 10 what? Days? Months? And the doctor continued, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's not a true story, it's only a joke. What happens to the consciousness? First of all, it's a stream of consciousness. People ask, what is consciousness? It's consciousnesses. There's 6 different types, but this is the stream of consciousness. When a person dies, it's not the 5 consciousnesses, it's the 6 consciousness, that stream of consciousness, the mind consciousness. What happens to it if it's unexpectedly? It just floats outside the body. And then you see your body down there, and it's dead. So one thing which we always try and do, a person can sometimes stay around just in that state after death. Sometimes they don't have much mindfulness. Sometimes they're not really sure what's happening. It's like those dreams you have. Sometimes in a dream you don't know whether you're awake or you're asleep. And this is sometimes like those states for some people, and those are the people who are just like wandering around not knowing what they're doing, what they're up to. And those are the people, if ever the monks are around or the nuns, one of the things we do just to let them know you're dead, give them some good chanting, now's the time to let go of this realm and go to a much better realm. And if a person is in a clear stream of consciousness, they may stay around a while just to finish off our business, to make sure that, you know, what hasn't been done yet can be done. one of those stories. This was an old people's home. There was this old man, old woman. They were the next door to one another, so they became friends. Nothing romantic, just like kind to one another. And so they chat together, and she would cook some things for him. He would sort of mend things for her. So they were really good friends. They became really good friends. And then he died. He died first. And the ones he died, that they were, the people around the hostel said, look, we haven't got all of the information for him. Has he got any relations? And this woman, basically his best friend, said, he always told me he has some relations back in UK. Do you know where they are? I said, no, he never gave me any addresses or phone numbers or emails or anything. He said, that's a really big problem for us because we need to get some sort of next of kin or something. Are you sure he never gave you anything? I said, no, and they had no records themselves. So a couple of days later, when she was sleeping middle of the night, she felt a hand touch her on her face. Gentle. She wasn't afraid, but it was just weird. And then she turned on the bedside light. You know, the door was locked, the windows were closed. It wasn't someone coming in to assault her. There was no fan, no wind, but she had a bit of tissue paper folded next to her bed, you know, on the table, and that piece of tissue paper, once the light was turned on, lifted up and then just fell off the table, went on the floor. There was no wind, no cause for that. So she wasn't scared. Apparently she kind of knew what there's something happening. So she picked up that piece of paper, had a telephone number on it. And she called that, and it was this man's, I think, sister over in the UK. It's the last little thing this man could do for a good friend, was let her know just his nearest relation. So she called it up, and it's all true. Sometimes, like a spirit or a ghost does that, just to, you know, settle the loose ends. And even over here, that happened once. There was this, I think some of you may remember her, this Thai lady, Poonsup Wong. Many years ago, she would come over to Nonamara Center to offer food. And she was really sick. She had a husband called George, and she was, they used to call him when I was young, a battle axe. George, you stupid husband, come over here. George, oh, I don't know why I married you. In front of everybody. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, she was so sick. You know this holy water, which I do? She always wanted some holy water. She said it really helped her. But not just a small amount of water. Sometimes I give holy water in a bottle to take home with you if you're really sick. In a bucket. 11-litre bucket every weekend she wanted. And of course, I'm very generous. I never asked why, because she was very sick. She was in a wheelchair. And then I found out why she wanted it. So I got a telephone call at Bodhinyana. It said, can I speak to Ajahn Bhava? I said, speaking. Oh, I want to come to get some of your holy water. You know, how much do you charge? I said, we never charge for holy water. It's always for free. No, you charge. No, I don't. So, well, I usually get it from this Thai lady, Poonsup Wong, at I think, you know, $10 a bottle. It's really good. And then I figured out what she was up to. She was getting a whole bucket for me and rebottling it and selling it on. And this Chinese guy said, I want to cut out the middleman or the middlewoman, get it cheaper. That's the end of her holy water. But anyway, she died a little bit later on. And when she died, before she died, she came to see me and said, Ajahn Brahm, look, my husband is so stupid, I don't think I can trust him to do my funeral service. So can you, Ajahn Brahm, do the funeral for me? And in return, you pay everything, Ajahn Brahm. In return, I'll bequeath half of my estate. It was only like a small house in a poor suburb of Midland. I said, look, I'd love to help, but I'm a monk. I can't do that. So I said, I'll tell my committee. So the committee had a look at it. The treasurer said, that's a pretty good deal. So they signed the papers, whatever it was. And so when she died, I did a funeral service, and the Buddhist Society paid all the bills. And they were waiting for the reimbursement when they got half the estate. And I asked the husband, George, I said, George, have you found the will yet? And he said, no, I've lost it. I don't know where it is. And we're Buddhists, we don't pressure people. We didn't need to pressure people, because a few days later, he arrived in monastery really early in the morning, about 6 o'clock, I think, before breakfast. He arrived really early in a taxi all the way from Perth. That's a lot of money, it's expensive. And he jumped out of the taxi. Where's Ajahn Brahm? I happened to be there. He said, Ajahn Brahm, here's the will. Here's the will. Take it now. Please, please, take it quick. I've never seen him so scared. In fact, of all the human beings I've seen, I don't think I've seen anybody as scared as George that morning. What happened? She came last night, puts up as a ghost. George, George, you know where that will is. Go and give it to Ajahn Brahm as soon as possible. He couldn't give me that will fast enough, the poor fellow. He was terrified. He was terrified of his wife when she was alive. Imagine how more terrified when she was a ghost. So she did that to make sure that everything was settled. So be very careful. If you promise your husband or your wife that when you die you'll give a donation to the nuns' monastery, if you don't fulfill that, they'll come in the evening and wake you up. Okay, anyway. So that's sometimes when people go, a ghost. They're just coming there, just finishing old jobs. Okay, it's 2:15 now. Shall we finish now? Yes, enough. There's a few questions here, but just always think you didn't have enough good karma to have them answered. So... Well, it's all about karma, isn't it? They'll be answered tomorrow. Okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Excellent. Okay, you can carry on meditating if you wish, or go back and see the ghosts. Now, an important thing is, and this is, you know, with the honesty of a monk, the ghosts cannot come into this monastery or into this jhana grove, because the ghosts and spirits are scared of monks and nuns. So you're protected here. It's weird, but it's true. Years and years and years ago, when I went looking for the ghosts over in Wat Nanachat, which was a cremation ground, when you found them, they were surprised. I said, you can see us? Oh yeah. And they were just running away, they were terrified. I couldn't understand why ghosts would be terrified of humans. I was totally outnumbered. This should be obvious to you. In the realms of rebirth, you know, human beings are much higher than ghosts. We've got far more power. The trouble is you don't realize that. As monks, we do realize that. We just tell the ghost, ghost, stop misbehaving. So if any ghost sneaks into your room, please tell it, look, if you carry on messing around, I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm, ah, no, please, no, don't tell him. I didn't mean it. Or just send him to my room. I'll sort the naughty ghosts out. Okay. Anyway, have a beautiful night.